aside, maybe a few others, but it's a short list. So I will be the messenger of, about animal research, even though I'm somewhat troubled by it. So with animal research, you do pretty intense manipulations, and then take a look and see what's actually going on in the brain, you know, afterward. The implicit point I think you're raising is that neuroscience is a baby science. There's so much that's not known. So often what we can do is speculate plausibly, and if there's little downside to the implication of this plausible speculation, why not try it for yourself, right? I think also that inside the natural frame, evidence of mental change is evidence for neural change. Otherwise, we're left with transcendental or supernatural explanations. So if we know from research in psychology that people who repeatedly cultivate qualities, let's say, they do compassion practice repeatedly, or, you know, loving kindness practice, they develop more and more of a trait of being caring and loving and kind, and they also become, they have increasingly ready access to states of mind that are caring and compassionate, kind and loving. That's evidence for mental change. Well, there must, inside the natural frame, be some kind of underlying change in the brain. And there is clear evidence from psychological research that people who do those kind of practices do become more and more able to access just quickly and respond quickly to relational experiences, which would plausibly imply that there is some kind of increase, among other things, of oxytocin receptors, including in the alarm bell of the brain, the amygdala, which is one way in which social support helps calm people down. And repeated experiences of social support help people become gradually more and more resilient. Yeah. All right. One more conceptual, then we'll hit more. Please.
I don't understand fully what you mean by engaging, by the full implication of what embodiment in life means. What Buddhist tradition is reluctant
to. Yeah.
Could you say
that? What I mean by that is that. Thank you. So, what do I mean by, in my personal opinion, a kind of reluctance in some quarters to really engage the implications of grounding the mind in life, right? And what I mean by that is that for many people, if it helps, great. They're going to try it. They're going to get benefit from it. That's all they think about. And that's very simple. That's great. That's super. For some people, there is a very, I think, understandable reluctance or reservation about reductionism, about somehow reducing the mind to the meat in some way. And there's a fear, pardon me, that if one does that, then some of the majesty of the mind, the mental life, including subtle spiritual experiences, will be reduced to just neurotransmitters, right? Just calcium ions, just the gooey 3.5 to 3 pounds or so of tofu-like tissue inside the brain, right? And there's a reluctance to go there. That's really what I'm trying to speak to. And my own view is that, you know, drawing the language of the Buddha, there's a middle way. In other words, there's a way to take advantage of, because certainly the Buddhist tradition is at bottom pragmatic. The Buddha was interested in what was true. He was more interested in what helped, right? What was useful. And so I think there are opportunities to exploit, in a good sense, the correlations that are increasingly evident between flows of mental activity and flows of neural activity that gradually change neural structure over time. I think there are ways to exploit those connections and use those connections pragmatically while still retaining respect for the mystery of this gap
if you will, between conscious experience and underlying material processes. That's kind of, I would say, my view. And because of what I do, I've been on both sides of the situation. I've been yelled at from both sides. And what I mean by that is that people say, you know, oh, people come from the transcendental side, you're just being purely reductionistic. Other people saying, oh, the mind is just the meat, you know, the meat cost is the mind, it's purely deterministic. And I think there's something in between there. Meanwhile, we're suffering. What are we going to do about it? Okay. And that's where I think this next slide really comes into play. You know, if we don't get on our own side, if we don't help ourselves, well, how can we help other people? Right? And it's kind of put it paradoxically, by treating oneself like one really matters, in the same way one would be called to benevolence toward other beings, paradoxically, by treating oneself as one really matters, one becomes less and less preoccupied with oneself. Isn't that interesting? That actually the gradual internalization and growth inside of feeling like a good person, of having warmth and friendliness and kindness toward oneself, much as one is called morally to have that kind of benevolence toward others, and as well as internalizing what are called healthy narcissistic supplies, feeling seen, feeling valued, feeling cared about, feeling prized, feeling wanted, feeling sought. The internalization of those seemingly egoic kinds of experiences gradually undoes the ego. Isn't that interesting? It's really okay to be for oneself, not against others, but on one's own side. Last night we explored that in some depth. I won't do that with you right here, but I'll just describe that as the foundational principle. The idea of, you know, being at bottom a friend to oneself. As I think it's Southeast Asian Buddhist teacher wrote, and it's clearer in print than it is orally, but I'll try to make it clear. He wrote, love yourself. Just don't love yourself. Yeah, I think that just says it right there in so many kinds of ways. So that will be a foundational principle as we go forward today. Okay? So let's get into then the crux of the matter, or our focus here, which is about growing inner strengths inside. Inner strengths being my broad term for wholesome qualities of mind and body. And to get into this topic, I'd like to tell a story that you may have heard before. You might have heard it in a different version. And this is the version I heard the story. So it's a Native American teaching story. A woman was asked at the end of her life, grandmother, how did you become so happy? How did you become so successful, so wise, so loved? What did you do? And she paused and reflected a bit, and she said, you know, I think it's because when I was young, I realized that in my heart were two wolves, one of love and one of hate. And I realized as well that everything depended upon which one I fed each day. That's the story. Really quite powerful story. And one, it speaks to the presence in almost every human heart, certainly in my own, of the wolf of hate. Metaphorically speaking, that capacity, even sometimes inclination, to go toward envy or ill will or rage or vengeance, violence, even more. That capacity. Also, more to our purposes here today, there's the point about we're always feeding one wolf or another. The brain is always changing its structure continually. It's the organ that learns. It's designed. The brain is designed to be changed by our experiences. That's what's called experience-dependent neuroplasticity. Right? We're constantly feeding one wolf or another. We're constantly growing one tendency or another. Which wolf will we feed? And how do we actually do it? How do we feed the wolf of love? Or more broadly, how do we grow other strengths besides love inside ourselves? This goes to the notion of inner strengths. Resources would be another term for this, that are well known in psychology as well as in spiritual practice. We have virtues, patience, or generosity, as Alex talked about in the very beginning here. Generosity, by the way, comes mostly in non-commercial, non-monetary, non-tangible forms. The generosity of attention, the generosity of good-heartedness, the generosity of restraint. We also have the executive functions, well-researched in psychology, like control of attention, self-regulation of emotions or impulses. Then we have attitudes like optimism or openness, capabilities, mindfulness is a strength that can be grown inside a person. Capabilities, let's say, also like emotional intelligence or resilience. And then we have positive emotions. Barbara Fredrickson and others have really established the power of positive emotions, not just for feeling good in the moment, but also for helping us become more resilient and more able to bounce back from life's difficulties. And then we have the approach orientation, which is the inclination to move toward opportunities rather than being completely preoccupied with moving away from threats. Right? Or simply put, the good stuff. We want to grow the good stuff inside. In a Buddhist framework, there are many inner strengths. Think about the Brahmaviharas, the so-called divine abodes or the four immeasurables, compassion, kindness, joy or happiness at the welfare of others, equanimity. Those are inner strengths to grow. Another collection of inner strengths in Buddhism are the seven factors of awakening, mindfulness, investigation, energy, bliss, tranquility, concentration, equanimity. Also, we have things like wisdom. The three pillars of practice in Buddhism, virtue, sila, restraint, virtue, samadhi, concentration, mindfulness, deep absorption, and then panya, wisdom. Those are also inner strengths to cultivate inside ourselves. It's okay to try to cultivate inner strengths. I sometimes encounter people who say, but that's not mindfulness. Right? And I'll talk a little bit more about that, but I think that's based on a misunderstanding. We can be mindful while simply witnessing the stream of consciousness, just being with it, not doing anything to nudge it one way or another. We can also be mindful while we are releasing what's negative, while we are letting tension flow out of our body, while we are disengaging from beliefs or thoughts that are problematic for ourselves or others. We can be mindful as we gradually abandon unwholesome desires. And we can be mindful as we cultivate, as we grow good qualities inside ourselves. I mean, mindfulness is not at odds with cultivation. And, a major fan of mindfulness, such as the Buddha, allocated most of the elements in his Noble Eightfold Path to various kinds of cultivation. All right, so the question then becomes, how to actually do it? Right? In the context of the natural frame, inner strengths are understood to be rooted in some way in the body, particularly in the nervous system, and particularly in the headquarters of the nervous system, the brain. So then the question becomes, how do we get those green balls inside? Right? Strengths, and then the other stuff. Right? So I suggest we do a little practice right now, and then talk about what could be happening in the brain. Because our focus here a lot, basically, is how do you get those green balls in there? So you want to try a little practice here? Right. And then we'll kind of unpack it. What did it mean? What was going on? And so forth. So you can do this with your eyes open or closed. It'll be fairly brief. I'll tend to do a lot of fairly brief practices with you as we just try different things. And as I said earlier, in any practice, take care of yourself. Feel free to adapt my suggestions to your own needs. All right? So we'll give it a whirl. There are two ways to have a useful experience. Usually we simply notice we're already having one. There's already something beneficial happening in the field of awareness. It's also very legitimate and very skillful to be able to self-activate, to create beneficial, useful states of mind. So we'll explore both ways to activate or to have a useful experience. In the first way we'll do it, we'll notice an experience that's already present for most people in the background of awareness. Most of the inputs coming into the brain originate from inside the body. If you think about it, the five senses, hearing and seeing, were the last to evolve. which are very much about the external environment. The primal senses have a lot to do with what's going on inside the body, because those ancient worms needed to know what was going on inside themselves. All right. So the body is continually telling the brain how you're doing. And most moments, for most people of most days, the body is basically all right. It could be better. It's not a million-dollar moment. It's not a spa, a mud bath, whatever, you know. But it's still okay. There's enough air to breathe. You're basically all right now. That signal is coming up into the brain. It's constantly kind of the call of a night watchman, again and again and again. All is well. All is well. All is well. We tend to habituate to that signal, and also, for reasons I'll talk about later, we tend to not notice it that much because Mother Nature wants us to be always a little anxious for survival purposes, even when that anxiety is, in a sense, delusional, because there really is no tiger in the bushes. But so for that reason, we tend to filter out this internal signal that things are actually all right. But if you listen for it, in effect, you tune into it inside yourself, you can actually recognize that in this moment, you're fundamentally all right now. You may not be all right in the future, you may not have been all right in the past, but in this moment, you can be aware of the fact you're all right now. So, I'll be quiet in a moment here so you can explore this for yourself. See if you can start bringing into the foreground of awareness what your body is telling you, which is that now you're all right. And in the next now, you're all right. Can be oddly difficult to sustain this experience of being basically all right as a body. See if you can help stabilize this experience in the foreground of attention. Recognizing again and again the simple truth of enough air to breathe, the heart is beating, no shark is chewing on your leg, there's not overwhelming pain. There may be difficulty, there may be some pain, there may be worry. And still, in a fundamental sense, there's a basic ongoingness of all rightness. So see if you can locate that experience and then protect it. Allow it to persist in your mind. Even exploring a sense of giving yourself over to it increasingly as a kind of absorption practice, in meditative terms, a mini concentration practice. Opening into and becoming increasingly rested in the basic sense of being all right as a body. Okay, so we'll start transitioning from that focus to a different focus here. Each of these practices is like a little experiment. So we'll shift to a second experiment. in this second practice, see if you can create inside yourself the experience of compassion. Compassion being simply the wish that a being not suffer, so you could bring to mind someone that you feel compassion for. You have an awareness, perhaps of a friend or a family member or a child, someone grappling with difficulty. And you can open to and gently encourage without any kind of strain a growing feeling of warm-heartedness, of friendliness toward this being, with the wish that they not suffer. Perhaps strengthened with soft thoughts in the back of the mind like, may you not suffer. Or perhaps something specific like, may you find work. May you heal. May you recover from your divorce. May your chemotherapy go well. But see if you can create some experience of compassion. And then when you find that experience, also help yourself stay with it. Help the experience last. Enrich it, for example, by opening to it increasingly in your body. You can also absorb the sense of compassion by intending that this experience is gradually sinking into you, like water into a sponge. So I'll be quiet again for some moments as you explore what it's like to kind of marinate in compassion, taking it into yourself, letting yourself actually even be changed a little bit to become actually a little more compassionate in general. Okay, come on back. It's okay to keep feeling all right and compassionate. Obviously, there's a place for deliberate practice that is at least a minute or more in length, if not 45 minutes or a day or a week longer. On the other hand, most of the time, when we have the opportunity to register some beneficial state of mind and to gradually help it start weaving its way into our brain, so it has some kind of lasting value for us, most of the time when we do that, we'll be on the fly in everyday life. A dozen seconds here, a few dozen seconds there. So the fact that I'm doing practices with you that are more formal and longer and more focused, lasting multiple minutes in a row, a little bit later we'll do even longer practices, doesn't mean that that's the only way to take in the good. That's not the only way to internalize resources and grow inner strengths inside ourselves, most of which happens, as I said, informally during much briefer periods. So how was that for you? What did you notice or bump into as you tried that? And then we'll talk about what could have been happening inside your brain. Any comments about what that was like or questions about it? Please.
Fusion? Is it fusion when you get lost in feeling the pain and you don't the other person's pain, and you identify with the pain, and therefore you can't, like being stuck in the river.
Yeah.
You can't help anyone because you can't feel, you feel the pain, but you don't feel the helping.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. What he said, make sure I get it right, is what do we do with states of fusion, in a sense, where we're so, you feel the pain of the other when we're doing compassion practice, that in effect we get carried away by the river of their pain. We're no longer on the bank, as the Buddha put it, so that we have some differentiation from them that enables, that gives us a place to stand from which we can then help them. And it's a big issue. There's actually research that shows that people who are hyper sensitive to others and have hyper kind of porous filters have a difficult time sustaining empathy because they get so flooded, and similarly with compassion. So I think of the proverb, fences make for good neighbors. You know, this idea that, in effect, autonomy supports intimacy. And, of course, intimacy supports autonomy. The two are not at odds with each other, they serve each other. And one thing that is useful, and I've written a bit about this in Buddhist Brain about empathy, neurologically informed ways to support your own sense of healthy differentiation if you're a person who tends to become flooded by the feelings of others, is to tune into your body. Tune into that signal from the body, which will kind of ground you in your own body and support the sense of differentiation. This breathing is over here. You know, I had a client once who had the psychotic delusion that if she walked past restaurants and watched people eat, that the food they were eating was somehow going into her body. So she had to go home and throw up because she also had an eating disorder. Okay? And so, you know, we can definitely go too far. You know, so if you tune into your own breathing, you go, oh, the breathing's over here. I'm breathing my breathing. You're breathing your breathing. Okay. If I start thinking I'm breathing your breathing, I'm either having an enlightenment experience or I'm nuts. Probably the latter. So anyway, so tuning into the body is really helpful. Even visualizing, for example, the others over there, or just lightly touching their suffering. We're aware of their suffering, but mostly we're rested in our own compassion. Also, developing mindfulness, you know, getting more and more control over attention, being able to have their suffering occupy a kind of a fraction of the overall stage of awareness, but the bulk of what's in the stage of awareness is our feelings of compassion for them. Okay, great. Yes, good. Okay, maybe one more comment, question right there? Please, yeah.
Yeah, I'm the first exercise I found. It was hard to get hold of. Once the second exercise, looking at compassion, I noticed as I moved into compassion for this person, my breathing deep in my shoulders dropped, my posture changed.
Good. Well, thank you. So a lot of what she said, the part I'll zero in on if I could, was the sense that the first practice around feeling all right was sort of nebulous. It was more like an absence of something than the presence of something, right? And normal, I found it's oddly difficult to, we knew it conceptually. Oh yeah, no shark chewing on a leg. Oh yeah, he did, yeah. You know, oh yeah, no heart attack in this moment. No overwhelming pain, I'm not actually dying in this instant. We know it intellectually. And we also know intellectually that the body is telling that to the brain. But to feel all right, to let yourself feel radically all right in this moment, to the felt recognition of that truth, is oddly difficult to sustain. And my own notion about that is that Mother Nature doesn't want us to recognize that fact. She wants us to always feel a little delusionally anxious, to be on our toes, to help our animal ancestors survive. Right? Even though that adds to a lot of excess suffering, that kind of delusional anxiety. So I have found that to be a powerful practice, to tune into the basic, even while breathing, like, in this breath there is enough air. In this moment, the heart is still beating, still alive, still here, ongoing. That's very direct, and that's very powerful practice, I have found, because it just cuts right through a lot of the basis for the second noble truth of drive states, many of which are organized around resisting the unpleasant. If you realize that you're actually all right in this moment, that tends to defuel that aversive response to the actual, or more often, the imagined unpleasant. All right, I better keep going. I'm going to keep zooming here. So what in the world might have been going on in the brain? Well, learning. Changing the brain means learning in the broadest sense. Not so much learning 2 plus 2 is 4, but learning to feel more confident, learning to feel more loved inside, learning to become more forgiving, learning to develop more equanimity, learning to become more stably mindful, learning to access more readily deep states of absorption or concentration. That's learning broadly defined. Learning that it goes better when you're talking with your kids when you don't come from irritation with them, right? Learning that when your partner, in my case my wife, has a problem and increasingly looks like it's you, right? That it just works better if instead of leaning back and, you know, or going to war with her, you actually shut up and listen for a little bit and lean forward. That's a very useful, for me at least, kind of learning, right? So learning. How does learning happen? How do we grow? How does learning occur? What's the how of it, right? Well, the neuropsychology of learning is very well developed in both animals and humans. And learning proceeds essentially, to summarize and simplify and kind of cut to the chase with a lot of material, learning proceeds in 2 stages, from activation to installation, from state to trigger, right? From short-term memory buffers to long-term storage. That's the essence of the process here. It's relatively straightforward to get good states going. We're pretty good at activating beneficial, useful states of mind. But for these states to have any kind of lasting value, they need to move from state to trait, from activation to installation. And as I'll talk about after we do another little practice, I think there's been a lot of emphasis and focus on activating useful states of mind with this sort of naive assumption that somehow they'll just kind of sink in. Well, actually, they don't. The learning curve is pretty flat for a lot of people, and if not for most of us. The opportunity, I think, is to really get better at installation. Fairly quickly, I'll talk about how to do that. Okay? So you want to try another practice? Do something experiential again? I'll take a little more time with this one. This one's going to... So, I'll go back here. Activation to installation, and you'll start seeing the structure that I'm working with again and again, moves from have the experience in the first place. Traits are grown from states. Have the experience in the first place, and then to install it, that's a matter of enriching the experience. So we get a lot of neural activation. So we get a lot of firing to promote lots of wiring. And we can turbocharge the installation process by sensitizing and priming the memory-making systems of the brain, memory equals learning, by intending and sensing that we are absorbing the experience. So we have 2 fundamental aspects of installation that we'll talk about again later, enriching and absorbing. So that's the fundamental structure, if you will, the essence of the neuropsychology of emotional learning, or learning in general. Activation to installation, and installation having 2 conceptually distinct intertwining aspects, enriching and absorbing. And we'll unpack this more as we go along. Alright? So I thought we could do this experientially now, and then we'll conceptualize it then. Okay? So you want to try again another little practice? So, if you can, we're going to create this experience of feeling cared about. And so, bring to mind one or more beings that you know care about you. In other words, recognize the fact of their caring. It need not be a perfect relationship, and there are, in my mind, kind of five major aspects of being cared about, any one of which counts. Being included, being seen, or that the other person wants to see you, second. Third, being appreciated or respected, or others are grateful for your contribution. Or fourth, being liked, being on the receiving end of affection, or friendliness, or fondness. And then, of course, fifth, being loved, being cherished and loved. Any one of these aspects is a legitimate example of the fact of being cared about. So you're bringing to mind one or more beings who care about you in your life today or in your past. It could be humans, pets are great, animal companions, it could be nature altogether, spiritual entities. And then you're trying to help yourself move from the idea of these beings who care about you, the fact of being cared about, to an experience. It's very skillful to track this transition from idea to experience, from good fact to good experience. So see if you can get some sense of feeling cared about going in your mind. See if you can have this experience. And then once you have this experience going in some way, move into the installation phase and enrich this experience. Help it last. Protect it. If your mind wanders, come back to feeling cared about. See if you can help this experience become increasingly embodied, perhaps with a hand on your heart, or a hand on your cheek, or just feeling it more and more altogether in your body. Not getting complicated about it in your mind, not analyzing the relationship, just coming back again and again to the very natural, wholesome, healthy experience of feeling cared about. As you enrich this experience by protecting it and helping it increasingly be embodied, you can also absorb it with a sense of this experience, of feeling cared about one way or another, sinking into you like water into a sponge, perhaps sifting down into you like a gentle rain. Allowing a receiving of this experience of feeling cared about in one aspect or another. Okay. Start coming back. All right, so that is a kind of exploration of what it's like to move from idea to experience, from the recognition of the fact of being cared about to some feeling of it. And then there's the transition from simply having a very fleeting experience or a very mild, even incomplete experience of being cared about, to really preserving this experience and opening to it and protecting it, sometimes in the face of difficulty, including it arising not feeling so cared about, or not cared about by the right people or in the right ways. So that's an exploration there. How did it go for you? What happened? What did you learn from this experience? Comments or questions? Please.
I think I'm quite cerebral. I think I can think it.
Yeah.
I find it much more difficult to embody it.
Yes.
Yeah. It's quite a challenge, and it feels good.
Yeah. Yeah. So she was saying that she's quite cerebral. And it's easy to conceptualize, but to actually feel it in the body is more difficult. And, you know, for myself, for a long time I felt like I was numb from the neck down. Right? Because it hurt. And when I opened up to what was going on down there, emotionally hurt. And one of the things that's really been true for me is I've kind of gone into a fair amount of sort of intellectual cool stuff. It's really brought me back to an intimacy with the body. Because there's a place for internalizing useful thoughts, right? Like the thought that it goes better to not yell at the kids, let's say. That's a useful thought. Or I had a useful thought in my 20s that growing up I'd been a nerd but not a wimp. Right? That's a useful thought, especially for a guy, right? You know what nerds and wimps are. Like, I say this in Germany, they're like, how do you translate wimp? They struggle, but I think you get it. All right, all right. They're useful thoughts. But most of what's useful for us, most of those inner strengths, if I were to bounce back a number of places, these are non-conceptual. These are body states or emotional states or attitudinal states or especially motivational states. And that's what's so important to be able to really register. Yeah. And so to do that, to become more embodied, mindfulness of the body really helps. Tuning into the body again and again and again really helps. And just exploring this territory, coming back into what does it feel like in the heart to feel light, you know, and exploring this. So as you do that, you will gradually reclaim the entire estate of your own being. You know, if you think about it, little children don't have to be taught to have mindfulness of the body, you know, or emotions. They're already awash in body sensations and feelings and desires. We gradually numb out over time, but our natural condition is to be really tuned into ourselves. And knowing that is hopeful and optimistic. Okay. You have another comment or question? Great.
I don't know how much I was in the body or in the mind or in the, or my thoughts or my brain, but it made me realize that how many people care about me, and there was a feeling of gratefulness, that how lucky I am.
Great. She was able to come into an experience in her body of feeling cared about with associated nice experiences of gratitude for people who do like you, respect you, or even love you. Yeah. Good. Good. All the way in the back, Carol.
I noticed that being to mind one person who cared about me wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. I wasn't getting enough feelings. So I was kind of adding to it.
Good.
Eventually, I had a whole gathering.
All right. Well, that's good. And
it's like there was a kind of party gathering. We really like you. We really care about you. And I was like, okay.
I know. So this great is in a lot of ways. And one part of it is that at one level we could say, oh, that's sort of silly. And then on the other hand, it's very natural and important. We evolved. Our ancestors evolved in hunter-gatherer groups, relatively small bands. And the experience of the group really liking us and being our friend. It's not perfect. There are jealousies. There's this or that. Whatever, little quarrels and tiffs. But basically, you're in our tribe. You know, we like you. We want you. We'll work for you. That is a necessary primal experience for people to have. So it may sound superficially silly, and yet it's very important for us to have some access to that experience. The second thing was that you were being very resourceful in your mind, which is great. You were noodling around. What can I do to get a wholesome, beneficial state of mind going? And then what can I do to strengthen it, intensify it, and enrich it, and stabilize it so that it can gradually sink into me? And that's very good to do, to be resourceful inside our own mind. There's a place for that kind of resourcefulness. There's also a place, as I said earlier, for pure witnessing, choiceless awareness, where we just observe the stream of consciousness going by without trying to influence it in any way whatsoever. I think that's a fundamental practice. It's probably the ultimate practice. Right? On the other hand, to be able to do that, to be able to stably witness the stream of consciousness without getting caught up in it, without getting swept away by it, takes a fair amount of internal resource, the cultivation of various strengths inside, to be able to sustain that kind of choiceless awareness. Great, please.
Similar to this lady's experience, and I understand when you say resourcefulness in the mind, but then there's also resourcefulness in the body, because the more these people were arriving and saying, yeah, you're okay, this smile started coming on my face, and then it kind of ramped it up. And then the smile got bigger, and then it ramped it up. And so I just had this smile from here to here. So it was really interesting noticing how the body was getting involved in increasing the
feeling. That's great. Thank you. That's very skillful. So a couple things here. So, when I use the word mind, I usually mean by it the entirety of the information in the nervous system, most of which is unconscious. And then, more specifically, the entirety of our experiencing. So I don't mean by mind intellect, even though it could sound like that. So I'll try to translate that sort of thing. So, small point one. Larger point, what you're doing there, I think, is very effective as well. We can work with the mind, with what's happening inside our thoughts, our feelings, and so forth. We can also very directly intervene in the body. We can do a little half smile, like Thich Nhat Hanh talks about, or put a hand on the heart or on the cheek, or lean forward into a conversation with your partner instead of back. Right? There's a term these days, embodied cognition. You know, body states follow mental states, but mental states also follow body states. And to me, that was something that was happening there, very skillful. Yeah. Great. Okay, another person, please.
I was glad that you mentioned about the relationship that we need to be perfect. And I noticed what happened when my mind went, yes, they like you. But
yeah.
Only if, and that reason to then come back to, that it's been prepared for, even when it's not perfect.
That's right. Yeah, she's talking about it was helpful to acknowledge that relationships don't have to be perfect. John Wellwood has a nice line, perfect love, imperfect relationships. It kind of speaks to some of this. And it also speaks to what you're doing in your mind in the moment. You know, often when we're trying to stabilize for a dozen seconds some beneficial state of mind, other things come up. Sometimes the opposite of that beneficial state of mind, let's say, not being cared about. And you're doing this skillful thing of noting that and going, okay, what am I going to do? Sometimes what works is to go into the thing that comes up, the block, if you will. Often, though, it's more useful to recognize it. Oh, yeah, there's my stuff, rejection, junior high school. Oh, yeah. You know, back to the fact that my cat loves me. Yeah, he really does. But anyway. So, that's that part. We're just tracking little distinctions. We're tracking skillfulness with the mind itself. And then the last point here is, as I said last night, I don't believe in positive thinking, positive psychology. I believe in realistic thinking. If one way to put it metaphorically is that reality is like a mosaic with many tiles. And among those tiles might be people who don't care about you or anti-care. They practice, you know, anti-metta, anti-matter, anti-matter. You know, they don't wish you well. They have ill will for it. On the other hand, in the total mosaic of reality, there probably are many tiles, many facts that are opportunities for beneficial experiences. For example, many people who do like you. On the 0 to 10 liking scale, right, it's a 1 or a 2. It's pretty mild. It's the people you know at the coffee shop where you get your thing in the morning, whatever, and you joke a little bit with each other. You're not best friends, but there is genuine liking, or there is genuine including, or someone over there genuinely appreciates you or respects you or sees good in you, right? Or there is over there in the present or in the past someone who factually loves you, right? So for me, it's about seeing reality, the totality of it. And as we'll get to shortly, in the face of the tendency of the mind to over-focus on the, as it were, negative facts, the bad news facts, and miss all kinds of good news facts in our preoccupation with the negative. Okay. So how about I keep going? We'll have a break in maybe 15-ish minutes, I'm okay, and we'll come back again. So what was going on here? I want to talk a little more about this neuropsychology of learning, the how of growing the good inside ourselves. So if you think about it, we primarily grow inner strengths, which are traits, from experiences of that inner strength. Experiences of compassion, experiences of feeling cared about, experiences of gratitude. We grow these inner strengths by having experiences of that that are not merely activated as a pleasant passing moment, but are in fact installed, encoded into neural structure in some way, in some fashion, so that there is lasting value, not merely a passing, beneficial, pleasant moment. In other words, we're helping activated states of these inner strengths to become installed bit by bit, increasingly, as more and more stable traits. For example, we become more compassionate by repeatedly internalizing experiences of compassion. We become more grateful, internalizing experiences of gratitude, more mindful by repeatedly experiencing mindfulness and registering what this experience is like so it increasingly stabilizes inside ourselves. Without installation, the experience is better than a stick in the eye, but it doesn't lead to learning. There's no lasting value. And this fact has huge implications. Speaking to myself as a long-term therapist, teacher, person, you know, it's humbling for me, at least, and disturbing in some way, to realize that the vast majority of the beneficial, useful thoughts, feelings, states of mind, and so forth that I cultivated or were present in my own mind, or that I cultivated or encouraged in the minds of my clients, it's something to realize that most of those states were wasted on the brain. They had no lasting value. They didn't convert. They didn't get encoded. They didn't get installed in any sense in neural structure. Momentarily pleasant, better than a stick in the eye, but no learning curve. Flat learning curve. This is the fundamental weakness. It's the dirty little secret in psychotherapy and coaching, mindfulness training, human resources development, character education for children. Most activated beneficial states have no lasting value. They're wasted on the brain. If you take a look at this quote here in the next slide, using psychotherapy as one kind of mental practice, one form, one intervention in the mind. Psychotherapy is a robust intervention, generally speaking, on average. It doesn't work for everybody, it's not for everybody, but on average, it looks really good compared to all kinds of other interventions for mental health, even compared to physical health interventions of various kinds. But it's also true that even though psychotherapy on average is quite a powerful intervention, research on psychotherapy 30 years ago established average effect sizes this much, 6/10, 8/10 of a standard deviation, effectively. Average outcome today, 30 years later, is just the same. Think of it. 30 years in psychotherapy world of new ideas, new personalities, tons of research, new treatments, more and more sophisticated understandings, more and more integration of the best of different approaches. Great. Still, no significant improvement in average response to treatment, average outcome. It'd be like, you know, investing 30 years in research on some disease, let's say some form of cancer, and even after 30 years of investment and development, average survival is no better than it was 30 years ago. That's the state of the art in psychotherapy world. I think that's because we've gotten a lot better over 30 years at activating various states of mind, but fundamentally no better at installing them in the brain. And without that installation, there's no lasting value. That's why I think where the opportunity really is focusing on the installation phase of learning. How do we help people stabilize these activated states so that they can last long enough? Long enough depends on the person and the state, but long enough to transfer out of short-term memory buffers into long-term storage. Right? We might be having one useful, beneficial, even enjoyable mental state after another, a moment of gratitude, a moment of well-being, a moment of recognizing that you're all right now, a moment of love, a moment of feeling loved. But the incoming positive experience, the incoming beneficial experience, dislodges the current beneficial experience from the short-term memory buffers before it has a chance to gradually sift down into long-term storage. So what do you think about this so far?
I'm going to say that last again.
Yeah. So we have, and again, I'm summarizing a lot of material, but to try to get to the essence of it, two-stage process for both conceptual learning as well as emotional learning. Usually, our beneficial states of mind need to be sustained in short-term memory buffers, like a little bucket sitting here that's kind of small, right? And new experiences, new information replace what was previously held there. They kind of dislodge it and move it out, right? Whatever is held in awareness in that short-term memory buffer needs to be sustained in that buffer, typically for at least a few seconds, if not longer, for there to be transfer into long-term storage, for there to be encoding into long-term storage, for there to be the movement from activated mental state to increasingly installed neural trait. Right? That's what I was saying. And in a little bit, I'll talk about five well-established factors in the neuropsychology of learning that tend to increase encoding. To go back to the quotation from the Buddha that I had on the screen here in the very beginning, it's drop by drop. It's bit by bit, right? In the frame in which neuroscience is a baby science, the exactitude of how long or how much isn't very well understood. For me, it boils down to MoBETA. In other words, more episodes in which we're attempting to register a useful experience, and inside episodes, more engagement, more embodied experiencing, more intensity, more duration, more recognition of what could be fresh about this experience to really help it land, more recognition of salience, of personal relevance. Why should I care about this experience? Any one of which of those factors I just named, which I'll talk about again later in a more formal way, any one of those factors will tend to increase the encoding and steepen the learning curve inside that episode. Okay, great. Please.
Just what you said, maybe I want to ask you whether you think that this porousness or this lack of being able to hold on to stuff and to absorb it is contributes to a culture and to the growth of addiction.
Oh, that's a very deep point. So the point you raised, if I can do justice to it, is, and the question is, does this tendency to not internalize, to not truly take in, to receive in an embodied intimacy with ourselves, does this tendency drive addictive hungers? And I think the answer, in my view, suspect for you as well, is a big yes. And I'll talk a lot more about this. Paradoxically, cultivation, the repeated internalization of the felt sense of core needs met, gradually undoes craving. This is a big theme I'll come back to again and again. In other words, by repeatedly experiencing that you're basically safe and basically satisfied and basically connected, basically, there's an enoughness, it's okay, that gradually reduces the internal sense of deficit or disturbance that produces a drive state in our biology, which is another term for craving and clinging. And I think it's poignant and ironic and even tragic that cultures that are so saturated with material resources, so surrounded by opportunities for useful experiences, are among the most addictive cultures in the world. And it reminds me of the metaphor in Tibetan Buddhism of a hell realm of the hungry ghosts. These are godlike creatures whose appetites are represented as enormous bellies, and yet their capacity to satisfy their appetites in a lasting way are represented metaphorically by a tiny little pinhole for a mouth. Right? And when I think about American culture, which is my native country, it just seems to me to be very much the land of the hungry ghost. And I think a lot of it is that people don't actually let it land, these useful, beneficial experiences, and which perpetuates a kind of hunger. And meanwhile, painful, harmful experiences, quote-unquote negative experiences, painful, harmful experiences, are being rapidly encoded into neural structure. But I think that before I get into this negative material, I better give you a bathroom break. Otherwise...